We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Got a lineup of uplifting content for everyone today.
Yes.
Let's start out with the Seattle Police Department.
As we often do.
Yes. Carolyn Bick of the South Seattle Emerald had an article in the Emerald last night, I believe it was, or yesterday.
Yesterday afternoon.
Yeah. And the title is Techs Show Former SPD Chief Best Involved in Plan to Abandon the East Precinct. Okay. So.
Judging just from that headline. That means that both she and Jenny Durkin lied through their teeth at the time.
Yes. So according to the text messages, and she actually posted a link in her article to the text messages that she received, Carmen Best's text messages, it appears that former police chief Carmen Best worked with assistant police chief Leslie Cordner to respond to a demand by Deputy Mayor Casey Sixkiller to start evacuating the East Precinct. So apparently, even though Carmen Best told the OPA and then told others after the fact that she didn't know anything about it, apparently she knew all about it and that she was part of a team that was planning for how to remove equipment, computers, and personnel from the East Precinct building on June 8th, 2020, during the George Floyd protests. And it was the abandonment of the East Precinct, in Carmen Best's own words, that led to the establishment of the Capitol Hill, first what was called the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, and then later the CHOP. Okay. So, And it's really clear that through Cordner and Sixkiller that Best was in contact with former Mayor Jenny Durkin, and that it was a team that was a combination of the mayor, the deputy mayor, the chief of police and police management staff that kind of worked through the scenarios and decided, okay, well, we'll withdraw from the East Precinct and allow protesters to march past it, and that was a decision that was made at top levels. So yeah, it seems really clear now that both Jenny Durkin and Carmen Best were lying when they said they didn't know anything about it. And I'm gonna read a couple of quick quotes from Bick's article. One is a paragraph a short ways down in the article. It says, according to the text log that the Emerald had obtained, at 10:27:44 a.m. on June 8th, 2020, Best received a text message from Cordner. It reads, quote, from Sixkiller, presumably meaning former Deputy Mayor Casey Sixkiller, quote, I want to see a plan to remove firearms, ammunition, and evidence from the East Precinct today. That plan should be fully capable of being executed by 5 p.m. today, end quote. So there it is, coming from Durkin's office through Deputy Mayor Casey Sixkiller, the order or the establishment of a plan to begin evacuation of the East Precinct that could be finished by 5 p.m. the same day. Okay. And then I'm going to read you another quote a couple more paragraphs down. This is Best's message. It's, quote, the mayor already discussed with me and I will take it. Best message to Cordner reads, the timestamp on this text message shows Best sent it at 10:31:29 a.m. on June 8th. It really was in response to, Cordner asking, they wanted to meet right now. I am on the call to discuss the plan, right? Plus, I need to know how you feel about it. Okay. So there they are. You know, Cordner, trying to get feedback from the chief of police to give to Casey Sixkiller to discuss, you know, how do you feel about us abandoning the East Precinct building, you know, and Beth saying, the mayor already discussed it with me and I will take it. you know? Mm. So it looks.
I think she's actually talking about taking the call about.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But she's talking about taking the call, but it's what they were gonna talk about.
Right.
Here they are. It's coming from the mayor's office. Best mentions the mayor having discussed it with her previously. So clearly it was in, it had been planned for and was part of a strategic discussion made between the mayor and the chief of police. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think when both Durkin and Best said that they were out of the loop on that, you know, no. And I think this is a big part of what led to Best resigning. It wasn't just about the money. It wasn't just about frustration and, with the criticism she had received. It was about this in particular.
And you wonder how the on-scene commander, who they threw under the bus mm-hmm. by saying that it was solely his decision, how he felt about all this. Was he willing to take one for the mayor and the chief? Maybe. Yeah, it's badly screwed up.
Yeah, it's really screwed up. And I think that Best could see the writing on the wall when she realized that even though she and Durkin had deleted all their text messages from that month, that it was going to come back to bite her because the city was working hard to reconstruct those text messages by looking at, like, Cordner's cell phone and other people's cell phones, and that it was going to come out that actually the order did come down from the top, from Best and from Durkin. So
I think it also illustrates mm-hmm. Another issue that I've seen repeatedly over the last couple decades of, you know, seeing reporting on people in power. And it's the way they will create an excuse or a shield based on very specific wording. So she mm-hmm. said to the OPA, according to the article, that, quote, she, quote, wasn't involved in the discussion about what, you know, who was moving what material and when. And I can see where, in her mind, she was specifically referring to that.
The details of how to do the actual.
Exactly. And the fact and you can even read that in her, response that she's actually miffed that she's not being contacted directly by Durkin's office. You know, you mm-hmm. can see
it's
that
coming
in,
through
in the
Cordner.
Text.
Yeah.
Right. So I could see where she could, you know, justifiably in her mind present that as being true. Cause in a way it is, it's just not, no one's expanded on, the question to, well, you know, did you not know anything about it? And it appears that that might actually
did you
have happened.
Sign off? Were you part of the planning process?
Right.
You know, did you discuss it with the mayor at all before it happened, or the mayor's or your command staff or the mayor's deputy?
And that took place. Supposedly, a deeper questioning took place from the OPA on further questions. Right. But we don't know what those questions are. But we
because
do know.
Because because through the management contract that the OPA has to keep all that private. They can only release it if there's been some discipline issue.
And we know that the OPA has, as far as we know on every decision, mm-hmm. come down on SPD side on 99.9% of the stuff they look at. So
yeah, exactly.
So it's like, you know, the couple mechanisms we have for some transparency aren't helpful here. And it's only because, again, entities like, you know, Carolyn Bick and the South Seattle Emerald continue to pursue this that, you know, we're getting any details on this.
Right.
So, again, yeah, I've seen that over the years where it's like specific officials will come out and they'll say something like the equivalent of, well, the plans to invade Iraq are not currently on my desk. You know, and they'll say, and everybody will go, okay, so that's solved. You know, he just said that they're not on his desk. And it's like, okay, but he's literally saying they're not on his desk. It's not saying not
they're
in a drawer.
They're in a drawer.
They're on a bulletin board. Yeah.
They're on his computer, but they're not on his desk.
Yeah. And so you can hear that eventually you can hear that in different people's responses. And I'm always like, God, where's the follow-up question?
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like there has to be somebody in the room that can ask that question, you know? Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the items that came out this week. And there's also some heat finally generating, even up to the mayor's office, on sexual assaults and the fact that SPD has not been pursuing those.
Yeah, that the Seattle, it came out in the Seattle Times this week, an investigative report by Sydney Brownstone and Ashley Haruko, that the Seattle police have stopped investigating new adult sexual assault cases this year.
All of
the adult sexual assault cases that don't have a suspect already in custody. Okay, so if they weren't interrupted in the act and somebody arrested immediately, they're not being investigated. And that means no evidence is being gathered, no interviews are being done. That includes interviews of the victims of sexual assaults and potential witnesses, and that no search is being done for a perpetrator, and that there is a backlog of over 4 dozen cases that are on a waiting list, waiting to be assigned for investigation. Okay. And this came out because one of the officers, Sergeant Pamela St. John, who is on the sexual assault team at the SPD, was complaining about it. There are only five officers in the SPD to investigate a total of 225 sexual assaults so far this year. And that they're overwhelmed and they can't do it all. Okay. And at the same time, Brownstone and Haruko, the reporters at the Seattle Times, pointed out that other units within the SPD who don't deal with violent crime are not dealing with a staffing shortage. So, for example, there are plenty of officers to man the homelessness encampment sweeps.
And in fact, those divisions have been bulked up under Bruce Harrell.
Yeah, and that there are plenty of officers who are out directing traffic. Okay. And there are plenty that are manning special events, and that there are plenty to take care of property crimes, right? Because there are all these downtown businesses and businesses throughout the city that are complaining about shoplifting. So there's plenty of officers for those nonviolent crime squads, right? But there's a shortage of officers to deal with violent sexual assault against women, primarily. Against women. And so it's really an issue of, I had two responses when I read this article. My first response was, oh my God, this is the most sexist thing I've ever read, because women are primarily the victims of sexual assault, right? And the second response I had is, this is why we need civilian teams to pick up some of the work that's being done by the Seattle Police Department. Civilian teams can do things like directing traffic. Okay. Civilian teams can do things like manning special events. Civilian teams can deal with gathering evidence in property crimes. Okay. But the Seattle Police Department, and in particular, the police union is pushing back and saying they do not want to give up any of their work. They do not want the city council to establish any civilian teams and move any 911 calls at all to civilian teams. They're pushing back, they're dragging their feet, and they're delaying. But it needs to happen, and it needs to happen ASAP so that officers can deal with violent crimes. And we don't have this situation where a woman is raped. She goes to report it to the SPD. They take her name and phone number and say, we'll get back to you when we have somebody available. And she hears nothing back, ever. You know, I mean, some of these have probably been sitting for months. And that is absolutely unacceptable.
Yeah, I think it's a real failure of leadership. It goes to interim. He's been interim for a year and a half now.
Chief Diaz, yeah.
Yeah, Adrian Diaz and the mayor. Because these are, you know, these decisions, like the decision to abandon the East Precinct, are being made at that level. And there's been no transparency, no accountability. They keep saying it's a staffing shortage, but it's a question of priorities. Mm-hmm. Are you prioritizing, violent crimes against women, over, property crimes, or over, you know, sweeping homeless encampments for the people who actually have committed no crimes, but they're taking police resources because a particularly noisy minority of residents are complaining. And that was that's the call they've made, is to prioritize those kind of things over the victims of violent crimes, over a traumatizing event that will stay with women for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and it's not okay to say we're just short on staff and we're going to hire. You have to say, okay, who do you have working in the department right now and what are they working on?
Yeah, and if you say you're going to hire, on what are you basing that, given that there's been this enormous attrition in SPD over the last 3 years? You know, and we've seen over and over these rosy estimates, especially in the budget process that SPD has of, oh, we're going to hire this many people this coming year. And then they don't, you know, because they can't find qualified applicants. So, you know, you better start figuring out how you're going to investigate these violent crimes with the people you have. And it's not happening. And the fact that it's not happening is a deliberate choice. And it is absolutely inexcusable.
Yeah. I know a while back the city council discussed taking a piece of work that the SPD officers do, directing traffic, and moving that over to the folks who do parking enforcement, saying, okay, that's a civilian team that could do directing traffic. You don't need a guy with a gun who's trained to deal with violent crime out there, you know, basically just kind of waving cars through an intersection. That's stupid. But the SPD pushed back and said, nope, the union's telling us we can't give up that piece of work. That's Bog and SPEMA saying, nope, we don't want to give up any work.
And if you've got a guy with a gun who is trained to do violent crime and they're not investigating violent crime, it raises the issue of, well, why do you need the police at all?
Yeah, that's why people are asking that question, is because you're, you know. But I'm going to talk for a minute, too, about the Seattle Police Management Association draft contract that the city council is going to discuss on Monday and then vote on Tuesday. In their afternoon session on this coming Tuesday, June 7th, and it kind of came to Mike's attention, and Mike actually forwarded it to me because People Power Washington Police Accountability Group had sent a letter to the Seattle City Council this week, basically saying that they have issues with the Seattle Police Management Association contract. So if you're having trouble following this, there are two police unions at the Seattle Police Department. There's the Seattle Police Officers Guild, SPOG, which represents the beat officers and so forth. And there's the Seattle Police Management Association, which represents the lieutenants and captains, the management staff. Well, both contracts are up for negotiation. SPEMA, the Seattle Police Management Association, their contract has been agreed on in draft form, and the city of Seattle has agreed on the draft, and the union, looks like the union has accepted this draft, and now the city council just needs to review and vote on it. Okay. And they're going to discuss it and vote on it this coming week. Well, the letter from People Power, Washington basically says, you know, we've got seven problems with this new contract. And it's important that people discuss it with, you know, people come to the city council meeting on Tuesday, the 7th, and give public testimony and urge the city council not to pass this contract and just send it back, because it has these seven problems with it. And I'm just going to very quickly read through those seven problems and add one to their list. The first problem is they say both the OPA and the OIG lack subpoena power. And that's true. There's nothing that I've seen. I've kind of skimmed through the document and I've read the grievance and the internal investigations clauses. And it looks to me like there's nothing in there that allow OPA and OIG to subpoena and obtain evidence.
And that's been an issue certainly with OPA for like 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That they have to rely on the evidence that the police department has already gathered. Therefore, all they have to do is not gather the evidence and they're covering something up.
Well, yeah. And they can't subpoena witnesses either. So right. That makes it even harder for them to gather the evidence they need to do more than just say, oh, this complaint was made, but nobody came forward to testify, so we can't go any further with it.
It looks like everybody followed proper
procedures. Looks like everybody's okay now. Yeah.
Yep. Moving on.
The second issue they identified is that there isn't an objective observer standard in the disciplinary process. So it reads, quote, removal of any requirements that intentionality must be proven or that the information must be knowingly incorrect to sustain allegations of dishonesty. In other words, they're saying that the burden of proof is such that that you always have to assume that the officer is being honest, right? And in order to prove that
what do they say about assume? It makes an ass of you and me. Yeah.
Yeah. And that the problem has always been that you have to prove that an officer is lying beyond doubt. Right. And you have to prove the officer's intent when they do something wrong, that they intended maliciously there has to be this proof of malicious intent in order for the discipline to be upheld or discipline to go forward, and that's a burden, that's a hurdle that's too high. Okay.
Well, I didn't know.
How do you prove someone's intent, what they were thinking? You can't do that, right? So the third thing that they say is that allowing officers to withhold information until after an investigation is closed is still possible in this new contract. Okay. And that this is not permissible in standard court procedure, so it should not be permissible in this context either. Okay.
I'm noticing here that all of these problems work in favor of officers covering things up.
Yep.
Just saying.
Yeah. The fourth issue that they have is, quote, civilian oversight authority over allegations of criminal misconduct remains insufficient. So they're essentially saying, and I'll just read the full paragraph there. The CPC, that's the Community Police Commission, has asked for the OPA, or the Office of Police Accountability, to not only be able to coordinate with the proper investigative agency, but also to refer to the outside agency of their choice and to oversee any criminal investigation. The current contract only allows the CPC to recommend investigation by an outside agency and gives them no power to oversee said investigation. The lack of this authority gives the appearance of forum shopping and favor trading, undermining public trust. Okay. So essentially what there's, you know, I don't think I have to explain that a whole lot, but if the OPA and or the CPC could select the organization to refer a criminal investigation to and then continue to oversee that process, then it would appear that there would be some kind of public oversight, but there isn't. From reading those sections of the contract, it appears that referral to an outside agency to do a criminal investigation, the OPA can't do that. The CPC can only recommend that be done. It's up to the chief to decide that, right? And then the chief, or maybe, I guess, the mayor, maybe. And then that outside organization can kind of coordinate with the OPA if they want to both sit in on witness you know, on witness interviews, but there's no oversight of that process at all.
Yeah, and the outside agency might be something like, say, the State Patrol, or, you know, Snohomish Sheriff's Office. Or the King County Sheriff's Office
who have their own issues with discipline.
Yeah, they're not going to sit in with OPA. They're just not. I'm curious about how you can undermine something that doesn't exist, namely the public trust.
Yeah, right. And then the fifth complaint that they have are complainants are not allowed to appeal disciplinary decisions. Okay, and I agree that there is plenty of options for the officer to appeal disciplinary decisions. There are none for the person who was the victim of officer misconduct to appeal the disciplinary decision.
Yeah, so okay. All you need at any level is for the officer to win, and it's over.
And it's over. And there are many levels where that can happen. Now, the sixth complaint they had was that standards of discipline have no mechanism for being reviewed or changed by the public. And that's really clear from the contract. Again, the public, there's nothing in there that says the public can appeal or make any kind of complaint about how it was ultimately decided. And then their seventh decision. Oh, and they also mention it under that sixth thing. I'm just going to read this one part at the end of that discussion. They say, we would like to see the primary source for disciplinary outcomes be the Seattle Police Department handbook and other published and publicly available policy so that the public can evaluate them and officers will know what the standards are. Right? So that it's not some kind of internal thing that only internal personnel at SPDC and nobody else has eyes on it. So their seventh complaint is the 180-day clock does not allow sufficient time for a thorough and accurate investigation. And that's been a continuous complaint by outside groups for a long time.
That's been going on for decades, yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to add.
Because, again, as Maria mentioned with some of these earlier points, all you have to do as an officer who's trying to fend off a complaint is run out the clock. That's all you have to do.
Yeah.
And it not only stops the investigation, there's also a time limit on how long it can remain on your record. So if you had something 3 years ago and you got a similar, say, use of force complaint now, that complaint from 3 years ago, even if it was upheld, even if it resulted in discipline, it doesn't exist. So yeah, it's totally stacked in favor of the officer.
Yeah. So, and I want to add a couple things that I just from quickly skimming the contract because I, you know, only had last night and this morning to look at it, is that mediation, if instead of going through the disciplinary process through OPA, if the officer and the complainant agree to go through mediation instead, that starts the 180-day clock. So if, for example, somebody complains about an officer's conduct at SPD and both parties agree to mediation and they go through, let's say, 90 days of a mediation, but it doesn't result in a satisfactory outcome or the officer isn't, if the complainant decides, I don't like where mediation is going, I want to stop that. Or if the officer doesn't comply, you know, with the mediation process, then it gets referred to the OPA. But the 180-day clock has already started and it's halfway over. So then there's only 90 days for the OPA to finish their investigation. So I think that is BS and that should also be changed in the contract. I just wanted to point that out. And then the other thing I want to point out too is that when you look at a contract, labor contract like this, you also want to look at the salaries and how people are paid to see how the department incentivizes the work. Okay. So I was just looking at the salary schedule, which is attached as an appendix, and a new lieutenant, somebody who's newly hired or newly promoted, is paid about $154,000 per year, well over the median income. Right. And that's their base salary, does not include overtime or bonuses or longevity premiums. Longevity premiums are added on they can, depending on how many years you've been at the, either at the department or how many years you've been an officer. I want to point that out because sometimes people don't understand that employment agreements can include longevity that, what, that was quote unquote earned before you were at your new employer. Okay. Depending on your employment contract. Okay. The longevity premiums can add 6% to 13% above base pay. Okay. And then there are additional premiums, percentages above pay, base pay for special roles that you might play at the SPD. So for example, if you join the bomb squad, you get a premium added to your salary. Or if you do, if you're a permanent night worker, you know, part of the permanent night staff. Or let's say you're a traffic captain, okay? And this is why the SPD doesn't want to give up some of these roles that could go to a civilian group. Because, for example,
because they're incredibly lucrative.
Right. A traffic captain gets an additional 2% added to his salary. So let's see, 1% of 154,000 is 15,000. $30,000 there added to your base salary if you direct traffic, if you're in the management team and you're a traffic captain. Okay. That's extremely lucrative. And that is written into the contract. It is not a decision that's made kind of arbitrarily by the police management staff or the police chief or the mayor. It's in there. And this, these are clauses that the city council should be looking at. And I would hope that at least Teresa Mosqueda, who has been pushing hard to try to get civilian teams set up to take 911 calls, I would hope that she would look at this and say, this is not acceptable.
Okay. Especially since she has a history with labor. So.
Yes. And she should be, I think, as one of the labor folks on the city council, she should be looking at this contract very closely. So I would urge people to do what the People Power Washington is urging people to do, which is pay attention to the city council's discussion on Monday, June 6th of the contract, because they're going to discuss it in their council, in their full council meeting. And then on Tuesday morning, sign up and give testimony and or send an email or contact your city council representatives, particularly Teresa Mosqueda, since she's in all, she's in one of the two all city, council seats. Contact them and let them know what you think about the SPMA, the Seattle Police Management Association contract.
All right. Let's move on. Housing and homelessness updates.
Yeah, so some news this week on housing and homelessness. Mayor Harrell has finally released his quote-unquote plan to address homelessness.
Oh,
and I know, and it's not really a plan. It's an online data dashboard.
Oh, boy. Which,
yeah.
Oh, it's, hey, it'll be data-driven.
Yeah. No, I mean, it appears to be a lot, just a lot of marketing for the HOPE team and the Harrell administration. I mean, it's got these fancy graphics and everything, but it doesn't even pretend to be a comprehensive count of the number of homelessness in Seattle or of homeless shelters even. You know, there's not even any, it kind of represents the numbers as these are, you know, set in stone, right? But then when you dig into them, there's not even a pretense of reliability behind many of those numbers. Bruce Harrell,
the city has been playing games with its homelessness and housing statistics for years and years. So it's not a surprise that Bruce Harrell, who on city council oversaw a lot of those games, is playing the same games now.
Yeah.
It's just totally expected.
It's kind of a classic continuation of
prior
administrations.
Because it certainly doesn't solve the problem. It pretends to solve the problem, but it's all about trying to reassure the public that they're doing something. Doesn't matter what, but they're doing something. What they're doing is making websites. That's what they're doing.
Yeah. And kind of
they're also doing a lot to make it worse, but they don't
pulling
really,
numbers out of the air. Yeah. So Harrell made, Bruce Harrell made the promise that he would identify 1,000 new units of emergency supportive shelter within the first 6 months of his administration, right? That was on when he was on the campaign trail. He made that promise. And then he promised another 1,000 units by the end of his first year. So the
we've been through 6 months, haven't we?
Yeah. Note the way it was phrased. He would identify, right? Not create.
Right.
Okay. So the data dashboard identifies 1,300 units of shelter that are expected to open later this year. Right. And it's not quite the first 6 months of his administration. So he's, you know, raising his hands in the air and shouting success and doing his little touchdown dance. Right.
Even though nobody's actually been housed.
Yeah. But I want to point out that those are shelters that were already underway before Harrell took office. Now, the mayor, of course, is trying to roll back people's expectations, saying that he only meant to bring these to light. And because nobody had advertised them before, or I guess been a cheerleader for these new shelters or, you know, sought to ease the feelings of people who don't like homeless people. Right. That is his plan, is to be that cheerleader. Right. That's his plan for addressing homelessness.
And you can get your own signature Bruce Harrell pom poms. For a donation through his reelection campaign.
Yeah. but I want to point out too, but of the iffy data on the dashboard, one of the numbers is the number of homeless people referred to shelter by the HOPE team. Now, it's important to understand that this just measures pieces of paper given to people in or near homeless encampments. Okay. And that no effort has been made to find out how many of those people actually use those referrals or pieces of paper to go to a shelter and register for a place to spend the night, right? And the deputy director of the Human Services Department has admitted that there could have been duplicates in that number, that more than one referral could have been given to the same person, and that may have happened multiple times.
And if you show up at a shelter, they may not have room that night.
Exactly.
Particularly in summer when, you know, there's a lot of homeless people, and in winter when people need to get indoors. Yeah. So those are the two peak times.
Yeah. And then Harrell's homelessness czar, that's Tiffany Washington, doesn't really care about how many people actually go to shelters. And she said that during the press conference where he rolled out this data dashboard. Because, you know, the city's only legally required to track the number of referrals, the number of literally pieces of paper they pass out to homeless people. They're not required to track anything else, so they're not going to, essentially.
That sounds like something city council could fix.
Yeah.
Just
now,
saying.
I should point out, too, that as when you mentioned city council, that District 6 city council member was there. Dan Strauss was there at the press conference, and he defended Harrell, saying that the mayor has the ability to move quickly to provision new shelters. But that, I should point out, that is not true. That's absolutely not true, and he should know better. The King County Regional Homelessness Authority does that now, not the mayor of Seattle. Okay, that's why the city gave up this authority, because the mayor didn't want to be responsible for provisioning new shelters and housing the homeless. It was identified as a quote-unquote regional issue, right?
Yeah, she didn't want to be responsible for her decision on the East Precinct either.
I know. So so it was like it was a total media circus, and a whole lot of stuff said that was either not true or extremely misleading when Harrell rolled out his quote-unquote plan for addressing homelessness. Okay.
Yeah. So, start with the word plan.
Yeah, as not being accurate. Okay. Now, also this week, the city council approved a bill that will require landlords to report how much rent they charge on units of each size that they rent out. Not just new units up for rent with a new tenant, but units that are already occupied where the lease is up for renewal. Okay. So all units. This
now,
will be the
now,
first time. Uh-huh. Go ahead, Joff.
you know, square footage is not the only thing that determines a price. You can have things like view or amenities. So you might have units of the same size that are different prices. Mm-hmm. So how's that handled?
I don't know yet. A lot is going to depend on how the program is set up. Now, I just want to say that this would be the first time in history that renters will have some clarity on the going rates for rental units in Seattle. Okay. There are a number of real estate companies that track the rate of house and condo prices and provide statistics on those and provide details about square footage, about location, about the number of bedrooms, et cetera. And the county tracks the assessed value of properties for property tax purposes. And that's all data that is publicly available on the King County's website. But renters have always been at the mercy of rough estimates made public by some private realty companies, one of which, the leading company that did that, Dupre and Scott, is no longer exists. Okay. So that's why the city council identified this as an issue.
But you can get numbers from Windermere, from Zillow, from all kinds of different websites.
About house sales.
Well, about rentals also. And,
yeah, but that's just new rentals. It's not existing rentals where the person is just renewing their lease.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And it's often not broken down by parts of the city because, you know, a rental downtown probably costs a lot more than a rental, say, in Lake City.
Yeah. So the specifics of the bill would require the city to contract with one of the local universities, probably the University of Washington, but it could be any local university, to set up a program to gather this data. So probably an online dashboard where landlords could go and fill out information on the square footage of their unit, its location in the city, because that will be part of it. And the amount of rent that the current tenant is paying or that a new tenant would pay if it were rented. Okay. So the bill passed 5-4 with council members Herbold, Lewis, Morales, Peterson, and Sawant voting for it. Alex Peterson was the person who sponsored it. Okay. Not
really?
Sawant. Yeah. Uh-huh. Council members Deborah Juarez and Teresa Mosqueda voted against it because they were concerned about the cost of setting up a new program. And to be fair, as council president, Juarez needs to be thinking about the overall budget. And Teresa Mosqueda is the chair of the budget committee. So I understand that. But the Office of Housing and the Department of Constructions and Inspections, they both said, well, we don't expect it to cost more than $5 million, you know.
And, which is actually very little in
which
the
is actually kind of
the
reasonable.
Overall budget. Yeah.
Yeah. Sarah Nelson, interestingly, opposed the bill for perhaps the stupidest reason I think I've ever heard. Her reason was that landlords shouldn't be required to divulge, quote unquote, proprietary information as if they hold a patent on renting out units. And I think somebody should tell Sarah Nelson that, hey, you know, there's no patent on renting out real estate.
Okay. Well, I think what she's thinking mm-hmm. is that landlords are in competition with other landlords when that's really not how the market is working right now.
No. It's based on supply and demand and what landlords feel that they can get.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's not like landlords have fixed costs that are barely being met by the
no.
rents. I mean,
no. The fixed cost, if that were the case, then rents would be a heck of a lot lower. Okay. So Alex Peterson, who is usually an ally of Sarah Nelson, he was flabbergasted by her proprietary information.
That's because Peterson, for all of his problematic, policy beliefs, is a smart guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he said, and he explained that his intention in introducing the bill was to help identify small landlords who rent units for less than market rates. okay, less than what the big guys do, and to use that information to guide the city's 2024 update to its comprehensive plan, and that hopefully this information would help keep those landlords and units from being gentrified out of existence. So he introduced the bill as a way, not just, you know, I see it from the renter's perspective, a way to provide renters with the power to say, hey, the rents you're charging are way out of line, so I'm not renting from you. But he saw it as a way of identifying which parts of the city have affordable housing, and that would guide the city council in coming up with policies when they review the comprehensive plan, policies that would protect those units and keep them in existence instead of allowing wealthy national real estate developers to come in and tear those units down and build new ones at quote unquote market rates, which are actually inflated. Okay. So I thought it was a pretty good bill. If you want to go to the city's website and read it, you can. I'm looking forward to seeing it put into practice and seeing the data once it comes out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on. King County Council considering a ride-free?
King County Council, King County Executive Dow Constantine actually introduced a new ordinance to the County Council this week that would allow youth ages 18 and under to ride transit in King County for free. On King County Metro. If the county council approves the bill, then the county would be eligible to tap into up to $31.7 million in state grant money, which was part of the new transportation plan passed by the state legislature earlier this year. The ride-free program itself would cost an estimated $10 million of that money. So about a little under a third of that would probably be used for the ride-free program. Council member Dave Upthegrove was the sponsor of this bill. Currently, around 25,000 middle school and high school students have free subsidized ORCA cards that they can use during the school year. There are an estimated 329,000 K through 12 students in King County, however, who would be eligible for a new ride-free program throughout the entire year, not just during the school year. Every transit agency in Washington State under the new Washington State Transportation Plan is eligible to receive transit money from the state as long as they adopt a ride-free policy for youth ages 18 and under. Okay, they have to do that first. And so far, all of the transit agencies in the state have announced that they want to adopt a ride-free policy for youth by the October 1st deadline. Every transit agency, there are no exceptions, okay? And that would allow them all to receive funds from the state as early as this coming January. So that's some good news this week.
Meanwhile, I hear that Sound Transit is going to start requiring IDs from everybody along with the proof of payment. I think it's September, I was thinking. But so
yeah,
it seems like there's a little out of balance.
Yeah. That's not okay. And I don't think they can legally do that, actually.
And a lot of kids under 18 do not have IDs on them. It's not like they have driver's license.
Absolutely. They don't have driver's license. If you're 14, you have your ORCA card your subsidized ORCA card that you got, you know.
Yeah. You might have a school ID, but they're
probably
not going to accept that.
Yeah. Probably don't have it. And you know how kids don't carry stuff on them all the time. So, you know, I mean, I don't think it's legal for Sound Transit to demand your ID on the train. As long as you have proof of payment, you should be fine.
Yep. Agreed.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay, let's move on. KUOW has been doing good coverage for the last week and a half of protests at Seattle Pacific University.
Yeah, today is day 11 of a sit-in at Seattle Pacific. The issue is the schools, and the school is owned by the Free Methodist Church USA, or actually that's the church affiliate. It is a religious school, but it is run by a board of trustees. and that board of trustees has a policy called employee lifestyle expectations that prohibits full-time staff from participating in same-sex sexual activity. By the way, happy Pride Month. This is something that is fairly common on religious colleges and universities around the country, particularly ones owned by or affiliated with Southern Baptists. But the Free Methodist USA, Church USA, has warned that the Board of Trustees that should the school remove that employee lifestyle expectations policy, it would lose its church affiliation. So that's what the board was responding to when late last month they refused to do so, and that's what has prompted the sit-in. And the students who were organizing the sit-in with support from staff and faculty and some community members also, I believe, say that, you know, they're just going to keep sitting in until the policy changes and they don't care how long it takes. So this is in the administration building at SPU over in North Queen Anne. So that is unfolding. As I said, community members have been participating as well. So it really could stand to get more attention. As Mike mentioned, KUOW has been doing a great job of covering this. There was a front page article in the Seattle Times, I think, yesterday or today. But it really hasn't gotten, TV news hasn't really been covering it, that kind of thing. So it could stand to get more community support and more attention focused on it, because the students there are absolutely adamant, led by the student council president, that this policy has to go. And it's basically a policy, banning queers from being full-time employees of the school. And there's no place for that, certainly not in Seattle, not in 2022.
Sexual orientation has nothing to do with your ability to be an effective teacher or an effective employee in the workplace.
Or a good role model, for that matter. Mm-hmm. Heterosexual couples have a much higher divorce rate than same-sex couples, for example.
Does marital status really matter.
No, it, of course not.
Yeah. It's time to come out of the dark ages, guys.
Yeah, it really is. This is, so 1970s, or earlier. But, it's a very unfortunate policy, one that needs to be changed, and, good on the students for taking a stand against this and drawing attention to it.
All right. Just about 8 minutes left this week's pandemic updates.
Okay. We don't probably have time to go too deep into some of the studies that came out this week. There were some good ones. A large U.S. study looking at whether vaccination protects against long-term COVID, showing that the shots only have a slight protective status against a couple of very specific symptoms, but not against most COVID, long COVID symptoms. This is concerning, obviously, because scientists are still trying to figure out, who gets long COVID, why they get long COVID, and they don't even really have a clear definition yet, because there's so much variance in the symptoms among different people. And then, did you want to talk about this? Your other studies, Maria?
Yeah, the two studies. One was a medication study. The study tracked about 2,000 patients who were hospitalized with moderate to severe COVID-19. The risk of death for hospitalized patients is typically 14.5% to 15%. Okay, but patients treated with two anti-inflammatory drugs had a lower death rate of 10% for those treated with infliximab and 11% for those treated with abatacept. So that's some really good news there. Doctors don't yet know why these two anti-inflammatories worked better than any others that they tested. There was a third one they tested that didn't work at all, other than that the two drugs were able to tamp down on the inflammatory cascade that the body sometimes produces when it's fighting off a severe COVID-19 infection. Okay. The other study was a vaccine misinformation study done by the Kaiser Family Foundation that found that 6 in 10 U.S. adults and 7 in 10 women who are pregnant or planning to become pregnant either believe or are unsure about at least one of 3 false statements about the COVID-19 vaccines. The study polled more than 1,500 U.S. adults, 900 of whom were women, including both English and Spanish speakers. 600 of those adult women were of childbearing age between the ages of 18 and 49. The 3 false statements were, quote, one, quote, pregnant women should not get the COVID-19 vaccine. That's false. The second one was, it is unsafe for women who are breastfeeding to get a COVID-19 vaccine. That's also false. And 3, the COVID-19 vaccines have been shown to cause infertility. That's so false, it's laughable.
A lot of those statements, particularly in Spanish language media, have been circulating a lot.
They have.
Especially online, yeah.
Especially the third one. Now, not only are they false, they are absolutely the opposite of what healthcare providers recommend, okay? Pregnant women need to get the COVID-19 vaccine ASAP so that they can produce antibodies to pass on to their babies. Okay. Women who are breastfeeding should get the vaccinated ASAP because again, that's one of the main routes that newborns get antibodies is from their mother's breast milk and mothers need those antibodies to pass on to their babies. Otherwise your baby is going to be completely unprotected against COVID-19. Okay. And then, the third one, COVID-19 and you get long haul symptoms, that's going to affect your infertility. That's going to affect your fertility. I mean, believe me, if you've ever had a chronic illness, it not only affects your ability to have children and raise children, it's going to affect your ability to desire sex. Okay. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
All three and of those are absolutely opposite of what healthcare, providers recommend.
And there was another study that came out this week, showing that, for people who are quote unquote vaccine hesitant, often due to that kind of misinformation, the most effective way to, convince them to get the vaccine, it's not in podcasts, it's not in radio shows, but it is, hearing from trusted friends, relatives, people who are close to them who were vaccine hesitant, but went ahead and got the vaccine, why they went ahead and got the vaccine and what happened, which is basically nothing. Because just they didn't get
just have that caring conversation.
It's personal testimonies from people you know who have gotten the vaccine. So if you were vaccine hesitant and your friends know it, and then you went ahead and got the vaccine, talk to people about it. Because you are in best position to convince them to get vaccinated too. And that, if anything, is how we're going to slow this pandemic down. Because numbers, again, are still up. We're averaging around 2,000 new cases a day in King County, which is a lot. The new subvariant BA.12.2.1, which we've talked about in the last couple of weeks, it is now dominant in the U.S., in every region of the U.S., except the Pacific Northwest, oddly enough. But overall in the U.S., it takes 59% of new cases. So it's not well on its way to overtaking the BA1, subvariant that had been dominant. Which in turn is, you know, these are all Omicron, but the original Omicron was supplanted. And they're not more, more virulent, they don't cause more severe illness, but they are more transmissible. The virus is mutating in ways that are ever more transmissible. So keep wearing a mask indoors. Alameda County in the East Bay of San Francisco, San Francisco area, reinstated a mask mandate for indoor spaces yesterday. So that's where this should be going. So far, state of Washington officials have said that they don't have any plans to do that. We'll see if it keeps getting worse or if it levels out and starts declining as we get into the summer months.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there.
Okay.
For this week. But there's always next week.
Yes, there is. And we'll be here.